From the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and sound bites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview, the weekend edition of Washington Watch with David Salkeld starts now.
This week on the weekend edition of Washington Watch, election protests, a prisoner exchange, good news on the border, and the faith of a president. Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, Christian husband, and Reagan Republican. On Thursday of this week, international news topped the headlines as protesters in Venezuela pushed for election integrity and a significant prisoner exchange took place. Representative Warren Davidson of Ohio joined Tony Perkins on Thursday's edition of Washington Watch to talk about that and more.
Congressman Davidson, welcome back to Washington Watch. Good to see you.
Always an honor to join you, Tony. Thanks for talking with me tonight.
So let me ask you this. There apparently will be an audit of the Venezuelan election results. But based on what we know of how Venezuela operates, what we've seen thus far since the Sunday election, are we sure that this is going to be a transparent audit?
Well, of course not. I mean, we're not confident we had transparent audits in some of our own states. And the idea that the Maduro administration is going to submit data to the United States or the international community that is somehow going to be trustworthy, I think, you know, you'd be crazy not to have some suspicions about it. So there are a lot of irregularities in the Venezuelan election. And the question is, what are the Venezuelan people doing about it? And they're protesting pretty strongly. Unfortunately, there's a pretty brutal crackdown underway by the Maduro regime.
Do you see any parallels to what we've seen here in the United States?
Well, I mean, certainly not the kind of level of violence that is going on in Venezuela. You know, some people would say that January 6th was some kind of insurrection. It was a peaceful protest. There were people that crossed the line and did inappropriate things. But that's not what's going on in Venezuela. You've got an administration that is literally engaged in a very brutal crackdown, rounding up, opposition influencers and trying to silence opposition before it gets a chance to build. But the protests are strong all over the country. People feel like this election was not an honest election inside Venezuela. And I think that's the thing, is if you're going to go through democratic processes, you have to do the work to make sure that people trust the results. And unfortunately, in our own country, we still have tens of millions of people who don't trust the outcome of whether you're talking 2016 or 2020. Democrats don't want to trust 2016's election. Republicans broadly don't want to trust the 2020 election. And the hope is that we've done the right things and we will have the observers in place in our own country to make sure we have a trustworthy outcome. And maybe Venezuela, if nothing else, will be a caution for our own country to make sure that we have truly auditable results so that if there are questions, they can be scrutinized and proven valid.
What can the Biden administration do? What pressure can they apply to Venezuela? I mean, Venezuela has been, you know, going south very rapidly over the last several years. We have very little contact with them. What can be done?
Well, the Biden administration opened it up. I mean, there was a big limitation on using Venezuelan oil in the United States. And because oil is a commodity around the world, lots of others were coming in and scooping up Venezuelan oil. And this pumped up the Venezuelan economy. And so the Biden administration opened everything up to Venezuela, which made their oil even more accessible. It effectively nullified the sanctions on oil from Venezuela. And frankly, they've provided a relief valve for out-migration from Venezuela. So in a way, they've become allies with Maduro and helping him have cash and also empty out his country of the opposition. So we could reverse those things and limit Venezuela's oil-based economy and make sure that they don't have a way to, purge their country of the opposition.
That sounds very similar to the approach that they've taken with Iran. And the money given to Iran, fueling their economic growth and their ability to fund their proxies that are attacking Israel. It's also what we've seen with Russia in allowing their economy to go forward based on energy. What's driving that?
Well, the Biden administration wants no energy in America, and they know that the country still needs energy. They're working towards banning, internal combustion engines. They want everyone to drive an electric vehicle or share public transportation or something. They say to save the planet, but the reality is it's to have coercion and control over the population. The reality is it's empowering bad governments all over the world and weakening our own economy. So they need to reverse this Green New Deal and, produce more energy in the United States. And, you know, the limitation in particular with Iran, you know, Trump made it very clear, much like we had the Cold War with the Soviet Union. You can either do business with the United States or you can do business with Iran, but you will not have it both ways. And the Biden administration came in and reversed that right away. They flooded Iran with cash. And what does Iran do with it? They target Israel in particular, but they fund proxy groups like Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis, and they destabilize the whole Middle East.
I mean, Congressman Davidson, this would appear quite obvious, but I'm not sure that the vast majority of Americans are connecting the energy policies of this administration with the foreign policies and how that is creating greater global instability.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reality is oil is something that our economy needs. People use it. They didn't like the fact that, gas prices were going high and they were taking pressure for it. So they drained our strategic reserve and then they wanted prices to stay low. So they basically turned on spending with other countries, in particular with Iran, with Russia, with Venezuela. And these regimes aren't friends. They're not allies. They're not helping us. In fact, in a lot of ways, they're undermining us and drawing us into conflict around the world. So what do they do with the cash? I mean, in Iran's case in particular, they're very hostile to the United States. In Venezuela's case, they're destabilizing in South and Central America because of the way that they're flooding the border with out-migration from Venezuela.
Congressman Davidson, I want to switch topics for just a moment. Earlier today, a prisoner swap involving seven countries freed the Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich and two other Americans held in Russia. What can you tell us about these negotiations and that resulted in today's exchange?
Well, they were complex, multi-party. They involved Russia and Belarus, Germany, Turkey, help facilitate things. And, you know, we still haven't had all of our questions answered in the Foreign Affairs Committee. But at least Joe Biden did a press conference. I was glad to see him on his feet and in public. And I think the American people kind of needed to see that from the actual president of the United States. And then, you know, it's a good sign. You know, these two men, Paul Whelan and Gershkovich, Evan Gershkovich, were, you know, detained in Russia for a long time. I'm glad the Biden administration finally facilitated the release. I hope we did things in a set of good conditions. But you continue to see the Biden administration willing to pay any price, and it doesn't put punishment on people for causing harm to American citizens. So the fear is that you're really raising the bounty on American hostages. But in Russia's case, hopefully we see this as a path to some sort of peaceful dialogue that maybe can create a little more stability than we're seeing in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, I mean, the instability that we're seeing globally right now needs a little bit of tamping down, a little bit of calm brought in. But I want to move to another Biden administration deal. They reached a plea deal with the alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and two other defendants accused of plotting the 2001 terror attacks that allows him to avoid the death penalty. What do we know about this deal?
Well, the de facto sentence has been life in prison because there hasn't been a trial. And there's plenty of evidence. They haven't, for whatever reason, wanted to bring this into court. And, you know, the reality is this isn't really a crime. It was an act of war. And so how do we provide a just outcome? You know, even in World War II, there were the Nuremberg trials. So a lot of people and families in particular wanted this trial and they wanted a sense of justice. And by reaching a plea agreement, I think a lot of families feel like they were denied their day in court and a just sentence. And clearly, a lot of people feel the death penalty is the only just sentence for what was done.
Very complex issues that we deal with today. Congressman Warren Davidson, thanks so much for joining us today. Always great to see you, Warren.
Yeah, thank you, Tony.
All right. Congressman Warren Davidson of Ohio. All right, folks, don't go away. When we come back, a victory for the state of Texas in the Fifth Circuit yesterday. We're going to talk about it.
As a congressman, Jody Heiss witnessed firsthand how the gradual erosion of congressional integrity has crippled America's faith in its most essential institutions. His newly released book, Sacred Trust, Election Integrity, and the Will of the People, sounds the alarm on the attempts of career bureaucrats to subvert our elections and provide solutions to make every vote count. Help preserve election integrity and order Sacred Trust today wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Good to have you with us. The website is tonyperkins.com. And let me encourage you, if you've not yet downloaded the Stand Firm app, download the Stand Firm app. Go to the App Store. You not only will get Washington Watch in your pocket, in your purse, wherever you keep your phone, you'll also get our daily devotional, Stand on the Word, and the Washington Stand news feed, along with community. You'll be able to connect with others who are praying for this nation, who are standing for biblical truth in the culture. You can encourage one another. So go to the App Store and download the Stand Firm app. While Vice President Kamala Harris campaigns claiming she was actually tough on border security, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals handed the Biden administration a border defeat this week by reversing a preliminary injunction from a lower court and saying that the state of Texas can maintain a floating river barrier to stem migration on the Mexico border. Now, what does this court victory mean for the state of Texas, and what does this mean to the Biden administration and their lack of enforcement? Joining me now to discuss this, Texas State Representative David Spiller. He represents the 68th District of the state of Texas. Representative Spiller, welcome to Washington Watch. Good to have you back.
Thank you, Tony. Appreciate you having me.
So this has been a legal back and forth. What does this court victory mean for the state of Texas?
Well, it's just one more toolbox. And this has been something that the governor, Governor Abbott, has worked very hard at as far as this buoy measure is part of Operation Lone Star. So we appreciate the job that he's done. And I certainly appreciate the job that the Attorney General's office has done in defending this. The claims against it. It's a great win for Texas. And a great win for Texas also means it's a great win for the United States, because we're fighting a good fight down here and trying to secure the border when the Biden administration and our border czar, Kamala Harris, has failed and refused to do so.
Now, this, when a court, an appellate court, steps in like this and says that there's a stay, that they will not force the state of Texas to remove these buoys, these barriers on the water, that suggests that the state of Texas has a good chance of winning this case, does it not?
Well, I think so. It's certainly to overturn or to have an injunction, and the district court issued an injunction. We weren't surprised by that. But to do so, they have to meet several requirements. And when you read the opinion, it's a 105-page opinion, which is a lot for it's a lot, period, but it's a lot for a temporary injunction hearing. There are several things for a temporary injunction that have to be met under federal law and under state law. And one of those is the idea that you should there should be a reasonable outcome that you're going to prevail at trial. And number two is that the enforcement of this action will cause irreparable harm. Well, certainly just the opposite is true. Certainly we feel good about where we'd be as far as the ultimate end of the case, but certainly there's no harm to be inflicted. As a matter of fact, the harm is the other way if we don't do something to help secure our border. So I felt very good about that, and also feel very good about the other case that's pending is the one that was my bill, was SB4. We had a hearing on April the 3rd. In the Fifth Circuit. I was there for that, and I felt very good about that. They haven't ruled on that yet, but I've said all along, I think that they were waiting to rule en banc, which means all of the justices, on the buoy case before they take up and rule, make the ruling on the SB4 case.
Just for the benefit of our viewers and listeners, explain again that bill that you, that law that you had championed through the legislature.
Right. And that's the bill that prohibits illegal entry, illegal reentry, and violation of a order to return. So that's the landmark bill that the state legislature passed and Governor Abbott signed into law that says that we're not going to let you come in, at a lawful port of entry. So this bill was going into effect. It's been to the Fifth Circuit, the Supreme Court, back down to the Fifth Circuit. But we anticipate a ruling on that very quickly, very soon. And I anticipate that we'll get the result that we need that says that Texas can go ahead and begin temporary enforcement of that. Again, we're still waiting on a full trial on the merits, but I feel very good about that.
So, Representative Spiller, give us the latest on what's happening on the border. There's been so much other news that's occupied the headlines. I think this kind of, we're still talking about the border, but in terms of the volume of people coming across, the humanitarian crisis, that's kind of slipped out of the headlines.
It's a little bit less, partly, I believe, in fact, because of the efforts that Texas has made and our legislature's made and our governor's made to push back. And so it has been a deterrent. What we're doing is working. It's kind of like the weakest link. They're going to go to California. They're going to go to some other places. So it doesn't alleviate the problem for the country. It helps a little bit for the state. But just because it's not in national headlines as much as it was before doesn't mean that we don't feel it here in Texas. We do see it. We feel it. We feel the financial burden because of it. We feel the burden on our hospitals, our schools, our law enforcement, our jails, all those things, because we're not getting the money that we need to address those issues, among many other problems.
Well, I certainly think that the state of Texas has brought this to the forefront of the debate over the last few years by its efforts, not only in passing the laws, protecting the border, as we're talking about here, but also helping some of these migrants find other states to dwell in. I think that's helped bring the appropriate amount of attention. State Representative Spiller, I want to thank you for joining us. Always great to see you. I appreciate your work there in Texas.
Thank you, Tony. It's always a pleasure. Appreciate you.
All right. This, as we've talked about before, going to be a major issue. It is a major issue, but it's going to be a major issue in the election. And we can imagine, or we can forecast that the Democrats are going to run from this issue because their policies have failed. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about faith and how that shapes one's view when you're a presidential candidate. That's next. You're on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
Are you tired of the mainstream media censoring Christian and conservative voices? Are you looking for news about the most important topics of the day, presented to you through the lens of biblical truth? We have the solution, The Washington Stand, Family Research Council's outlet for news and commentary from a biblical worldview. You can subscribe to receive the latest news from The Washington Stand in your inbox every weekday morning by texting TWS to 67742 or by visiting WashingtonStand.com.
If you're a young adult passionate about seeing biblical values championed in our country, check out Family Research Council's internship program. This three-month program is both a discipleship and development opportunity where you get to take part in truly meaningful work and help advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and our culture. Featuring hands-on experience, biblical worldview training, free housing, and more, this internship is a great opportunity for spiritual and professional development. Check out frc.org/internships to apply today.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. As the presidential tickets for the 2024 election begin to take shape, we decided to take a look at the faith background of the respective candidates. We don't have time to share both on this edition of Washington Watch, but I encourage you to take a listen to the Washington Watch live program for Thursday, August 1st, when you visit tonyperkins.com to hear them both. Here now is Tony as he explores the faith history of President Trump with David Brody from the Christian Broadcasting Network.
David, welcome back to Washington Watch.
And Tony, great to see you. Good to be with you.
So let me just start with a couple of questions. Does a pastor, does a religious affiliation have an influence on people's lives in terms of shaping the way they see the world and the actions that they take?
Well, there's no doubt about it. I think it's part of the package, if you will. I mean, take Donald Trump, for example. I mean, he he and his father and his mother, you know, they grew up under the tutelage, if you will, the pastoral tutelage of Dr. Norman Vincent Peale, which, of course, we know very famous back in the 1950s, one of the most famous Americans to live back then. And if you kind of extrapolate a little bit of what Dr. Norman Vincent Peale was preaching, it was a very much a kind of a feel good gospel, if you will. It was a power positive thinking. That's the big book that he wrote. And he had a great oratory style. So when I talked to Donald Trump about all of this, he says Norman Vincent Peale had a real big influence on him, not to mention Billy Graham. His father, Donald Trump's father, used to take him to some of those Billy Graham revivals in New York. So, there's no doubt that it has an influence even today as to what we're seeing play out right in front of our eyes.
So David, has Donald Trump had or does he have a pastor? I mean, I've not seen him associated in a consistent or ongoing fashion with a particular church or pastor.
There's no sense that he has a particular pastor that he was tutelage under, if you will. You know, I remember, and this is classic Donald Trump. You know, I've known him, going on 15 years now. Our first interview was back in 2011 when he was thinking about running for president, 5 years before he actually did, or 4 years before he actually did. And I asked him about his church attendance and all of that. And he said, you know, I love church. I definitely go to church definitely twice a year on Easter and Sunday. He was proud of it. He was proud of it. Now, normally that's not something you're necessarily proud of, that you go to church twice a year. But with Donald Trump, he was. And, you know, it's just kind of interesting how, you know, he saw the world and sees the world. But ever since then, Tony, there's been a lot of people that have been speaking into his life, whether we know about the Evangelical Advisory Board members. You're familiar with them, obviously. And then Paula White and others. And so many folks, as I wrote this book, talked about speaking to him specifically about the Jesus plus nothing. That's the gospel, right? I mean, ultimately, it's Jesus plus nothing and saying the sinner's prayer. I'm told by many that he has done that. Now, a lot of people might scoff at that. Some of it may be lost in translation. And what I mean by that is that he's a New Yorker that has done things a certain way for a very long time. And I think that might be part of why some people might not quite get there when I say things like that, as I report them in the book.
Right. There's a pretty sharp contrast here, is there not, when you look at the two and their faith affiliation. Now, we're looking at the pastor Amos Brown, statements he's made very controversial, clearly kind of the social gospel, but Kamala Harris is apparently regularly attends, has been a part of that church for two decades. You know, Donald Trump more of freelancing when it comes to a church and connection with the faith community. And I think that even I've seen some in critiquing your book that said that, you know, Trump's relationship with the evangelicals have been more transactional than really a close affiliation. What would you say to that?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it's bogus. It's ridiculous that it's transactional. I understand in the sense that what they're saying is he needed evangelical votes to get to the White House, and I guess that's true. But the way Trump sees it, and I've actually spoken to him about this, I mean, what he loves about evangelicals is their passion for, quote, something. And in this case, it's God. It's Jesus Christ, the living Savior. And he loves the passion that evangelicals have. So he has a actual huge respect for the fact that evangelicals put Jesus above everything else in their lives. And so that is an attraction to Donald Trump. And that's really kind of like the DNA of what we're talking about here. But Tony, as you mentioned, I think the choice is pretty obvious here as it relates to what Kamala Harris and before her Barack Obama. It's a social justice gospel. Rooted in Matthew 25. That's what this is all about. It's right out of the liberal playbook. It talks a lot about compassion, but it doesn't really talk much at all about law and order. And so it's skewed. And by the way, this just in, the social justice gospel is not the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's a liberal political philosophy. And as for Donald Trump, he's more old school. He's traditional. He's more of a kind of a common sense guy who says, you know what? yeah, the Bible makes sense about a lot of these traditional beliefs. Now, I got to tell you, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, Donald Trump probably wouldn't have subscribed to any of that. But Grandfather Trump, someone that's later along in his life, is a different Donald Trump than the playboy of the 70s. It's a bit different. He still has the bombastic style, but he's a grandfather, and it's a little bit different now. He's gone to his old school roots.
David Brody, I want to step back for just a moment, speaking about the two presidential candidates. I want to talk more general, as you've been tracking politics for a long time. What do you see happening as it pertains to, and I've got my opinions, but I'm asking the questions. What do you see happening this fall as it pertains to faith-aligned voters, those who vote based upon their faith, that are engaged because of that? What do you see happening? What's the energy level you see this fall?
Well, I think the energy is extremely high, but it's a different type of energy, and I think we're all trying to kind of figure out the calculus. This is not the George W. Bush evangelical era. It's not the Reagan evangelical era for sure. And it's not even the 2012 kind of McCain, Romney, Obama era of what evangelicals needed to do. This is Donald Trump's party, and what does that mean exactly? Well, the culture war issues have changed, Tony. Abortion, obviously very important. Sadly, the same-sex marriage issue is not as prevalent as it used to be. We're now into all sorts of other crazy stuff, advancing things like, well, we go down the list of the LGBTQI plus, you know, X, Y, and Z agenda. They're into some wild stuff there. But beyond all of that, I believe from a faith perspective, voters, especially evangelicals and pro-life Catholics, are really looking at the weaponization of government that Donald Trump has talked about. Because, Tony, ultimately what's happening in this country is we have lost faith in our public institutions. We've lost faith in our government. We've lost faith in media. We've lost faith in so many different aspects of society that people are questioning everything nowadays. Mm-hmm. Get your tinfoil hat, if you will, at the local Walmart. And I think that's kind of where things are right now, even among evangelicals. Matter of fact, definitely among evangelicals. And so the culture wars of the 80s and 90s are not the culture war issues of today. There is some overlap if you get out right. The Venn diagram, but it's different.
I'll leave that to the vice president. David Brody, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us. Always great to see you.
Great to see you. Thanks, Tom.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I'm David Salkel, thanking you for being with us. I look forward to having you back again next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch.
The weekend edition of Washington Watch with David Salkeld is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you heard today, or to partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.